Colonel Collins, Reel 9. We were having a look at some of the aspects of a young officer's life in the front line. We were in the Montecamino area, but generally, actually, in Italy. You mentioned there was a routine for calling down fire support or fire offensive fire on German positions. What was the nature of the procedure?
Well, I was referring, I think, to when we, as infantry, infantry men in the forward areas, had identified a target and thought that the artillery support was suitable. We would communicate, I think, by radio mainly, but the procedure was that we gave our own position and the bearing, the compass bearing to the target and the estimated range. So, I'm speaking of occasion. You see, when the gunner observation forward observation officer, FOO, as they were called, and they did a marvelous job too. But if they couldn't be everywhere, of course, and they might not be able to see this particular.
So there'd only be about one per battalion, would there?
I think rather more than that.
But if they just weren't where your platoon was?
It depends. Very often, you know, they were in the plan, the FOO would go with such and such a forward company, or would go with the right flanking company, or something like that. So some companies had an FOO with them, and others didn't. But the point is that they've got all the maps and an ability to compute and convert, you see, from one set of references to another. I mean, they know where their guns are. And so if working from where one's own position is, then giving the bearing, and the compass bearing, an estimated range to the selected target, one would then give those details. And they would then compute from that the range and bearing from their gun position, you see. And they would then put down a round of fire, a round of artillery line. They'd say, all right. And I forget the actual fire, so we're going to have one shot fired or something like that. And then you wait. The time of flight might be, depending how far away the guns were, maybe 8 or 10 seconds before the shell arrived. And then you heard a crump in the distance, you know. And you looked around and you probably couldn't see it, or it might have been quite close. The thing was, in that very, very difficult and close country in southern Italy, the gunners felt that we weren't always terribly sure where we were, you see, because the maps weren't perfect. They weren't like ordnance survey maps. And it was a matter of speculation to a degree. If you've seen any of these maps, I think you have. But they were wartime printed and so on. It was very difficult in that very, very close and broken country to be exactly sure where one was. I mean, certain points like that, 0.420, one could identify that whole map. But if you were in some river. So they had to play safe, you see. They had to make quite sure that they didn't drop the shell on you yourself, you see, or because you miscalculated where you were. Now, I have in mind a particular instance, I think, is when I could see an enemy machine gun post under a tree, perhaps about 400 yards away, something like that. I could see him quite distinctly through my binoculars. And I asked for it for the artillery support. Well, the gunners wouldn't have it because I knew where I was, but I thought I did. Anyway, the first shell they dropped was absolutely nowhere in sight. So I said, we'd better try again. They tried again, and then they got one closer. Now, I was telling you about the drill. Now, the drill is then, once you see a shell, then from taking the axis of the observer, let's say oneself, to the target, what we call the OT line, take that as the axis, then in relation to that, you say, go right. I think we used to do it in yards rather than degree. You'd say, go right 200, go up 100, or something like that, you see. Anyway, I did that on this occasion, and of course it was a total fluke, rather like a hole in one at golf. But the next shell fell slap on the machine gun under the tree. And of course the gunners were delighted, and so was I. It was a pure fluke, like a hole in one at golf. But that was the drill, and I commonly, frequently did that.
How would you get through to the battery? I mean, would you be patched through?
I didn't get through to the battery.
You got through to...
I forget. Well, I think we... Well, how did I get through to the battery? It's a very good question. I don't... Did we get to the... Did we get through to the... The FOO was on the battalion net, of course. I think it was necessary to get a... To get a set on the battalion net, probably, to... you know, I couldn't have done that on my company net. So probably that had to be...
So it was indirectly from you to through the battalion net to the FOO, who was in touch with his battery.
I think he then controlled it. May I just digress and tell you a moment? You know, we had such a close working. I think this is very, very rare in the history of the war, if not unique. And I haven't come across anybody else who did this. You may have heard of it. We had the battery affiliated to us was 449 battery. And they were, certainly all the time I was with the battalion, they were our battery, and they were a part of 70th Field Regiment. Now, we became so integrated with them, you know, that we were just almost as if we were in the same unit. And we still now, 50 years afterwards, we still annually meet those gun officers who support us. And you know, it's a wonderful thing. I don't have any other battalion. I ask other battalions, I say, you know, who was your artillery support? Oh, I don't know now. But we knew, and we knew enormously well personally. And I think that's why I worked for
you. And you were overall happy with the support that they and the rest of the artillery gave you. I mean, even though they did sometimes land shells on you, you understood it.
Absolutely. They were brilliant. I mean. And their main concentrations, what we called uncle targets, if they had the whole of the divisional artillery. You see, there was a regiment supporting each brigade, and the regiment had a number of batteries, a battery supporting each battalion. And then, so in the division, there were three field regiments, and then probably a medium regiment as well. And then they would all register. I think we mentioned that before, to say they can lay on that at a moment's notice. Particular targets, and if they were divisional targets, they had the letter U, they were number U sometimes, and the medic name for U was uncle, so they were uncle targets. And if you had a concentration down on an uncle target, nothing moved in that area.
Did you, in routine periods, would you get much German artillery fire directed at you?
No, I'm just going to try and think a minute. In the early. Well, I don't need this as well, because I can quickly read back to this. There was a big distinction. During the first 5 months we were in Italy, the southern Italy phase, in this close country we're talking about there, we didn't suffer much from German artillery. It was mainly small arms fire.
What about mortars, the in-between?
Yes, so I found them, they had mortars. But in the main, it was small arms fire we were concerned about. I don't remember being particularly subjected to shell and mortar fire in those first 5 months.
What about
totally different in the Gulf of Iran battle.
What about the Luftwaffe? Did they intervene much?
Not significantly, no, I can't remember.
Were you happy
we
with...
We always took precautions, you know, not to be seen from the air, and we had drills for...
What sort of precautions and drills?
Well, you know, you had to make sure that you were camouflaged from above as well as from on the ground, so far as you could.
What would you use?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether we had. It depends if you're in a static position. It depends really. If you're in a prepared defensive position, expecting to be. Bear in mind, we were on the attack the whole time. Of course, even though you're on the attack, I mean, we were the advancing force. But even so, of course, all the times you're not actually in the attack, you're defending. Because you can't carry a whole lot of defensive stores. It's quite a different thing if you're preparing a defensive position, expecting an assault. You would then have a whole lot of camouflage nets and other things.
So you'd do what you could.
Do what you could, that's right.
And were you happy with the support from the RAF? Or did you see much of them intervening to sort out you? Could you call up an RAF strike on a difficult position, for instance?
In theory, we could, but I can't remember... I don't remember in particular doing that, not in that first phase. I think later in the campaign, when we were further north, I seem to remember. But I don't remember at this moment. I just can't recall the incidents of the RAF.
Right. We'll leave the sort of routine aspects and drop back into the story. So you'd secured these positions on Mount Camino, 0.430, I think it was. And you were up there for a couple of days.
Yes.
What do you remember happening next? That was the end of the Durham's involvement in that particular battle, wasn't it? Or major involvement.
Yes.
They'd done their bit.
You know, I can't immediately remember what we happened next. If I had a record, it would come back to me, but I can't remember. I suppose we didn't stay up on that hill, but we either went back down. I seem to remember we went back down through the Calabrito basin, down through the roads being opened up, and perhaps back down to the base area where we'd been before. And I don't know. Did we come out of the line for?
I think you were here to La Bagli for a while.
La Bagli, yeah. So that was yes. Well, we might well have done, and all sorts of things happened then when we came out of the line. When we went back a few miles, and sort of marvellously, you know, the NAFI wagon had come up, or the Church Army, and they followed us behind. And of course, one could get one's main kit and have a change of clothing. There were mobile shower units occasionally would come up. So if we went out of the line for a few days, we'd be able to get some rest. Some proper food, a change of clothes, you know, mobile laundry, and then a cup of tea and a ward at the Church Army canteen, mobile canteen, that sort of thing. So we may have gone out for a few days in some protected village a bit further back.
What would you do? Would they provide any entertainment or touring parties or concert parties or anything?
I don't think doing those very short breaks.
And would you have much contact with the Italian civilians?
A great deal, yes.
Well, how did you get on with them, and what did you think
of
them?
I got on very well. Well, at that stage, I hadn't learned much Italian. But later on, I learned Italian, colloquial Italian, you know, quite fluently, to the point that I didn't need an interpreter. So I could converse with them. But they were very rural, sort of peasant-type people down there in the sort of... I mean, we were out of the population center. It's rather curious, being in the... I've often thought things like this, since, you know, I was telling you about, we came out of the line for a rest and, you know, a change of clothes and all that sort of thing, and we were still, in all probability, further forward than chaps at divisional headquarters had yet been, you know. And certainly the gun lines and all those sort of things, if you were very unlucky, you find yourself with a gun line, and they kept you away from that. There's some people who... You know, actually were engaged in the battle in the forward areas. You know, they were still engaged in locations so far from the forward defended localities that we regarded that as being out of the line in the rest area.
You were frontline troops and you'd been in frontline action. Yes. Were you very aware of the fact that you were at the top of a pyramid, that not that many people actually went into action face to face, so to speak? Were you aware of the idea of the frontline soldier, and did you look down on base Wallace, things like that, or not?
Why I'm smoking is because we had one officer there whose favourite expression of deprecation was base Wallace, and he got himself in some bad trouble once or twice on that.
Who was that?
Jimmy Coots. Have you ever heard the name? He used to be known as Hacker Coots, because he'd say, "I'll hack you in the fork." He was a rabbit there. So, what were we talking about? I think I have to be pretty naive and simple-minded soul or something. I just found myself in that position. I didn't think it was odd. I did think after a time, when I became very experienced, and I saw other people being promoted, and people I regarded, you know, hadn't got a fraction of the experience or success that I had had, and you know, were promoted to command companies or to go to brigade headquarters and that sort of thing. But the thing was, of course, I realised since I was so much younger than most other people, I mean, I couldn't have been that's why I was. But no, I don't really remember any great feeling of resentment.
Did you understand the role of the like, Army Service Corps, things like that, the Ordnance people?
Well, yes, I understood the role, and I thought they were jolly lucky. I mean, you know, it's absolutely unbelievable when you think of how fate played a hand. I was talking to a fellow here in Bodmin, 12 months or so ago, and the subject of war came up. He said, listen, you went off to the war, didn't you, something. He said, I heard you had, didn't you? So I said, what did I do? He said, oh, I've already gone. He said, I went off to the beginning. I said, oh, I didn't know that. You know, what did you, where did you, when the war was? Well, he said, I went to the depot, I did my basic training. And then I was sent, this was a very early stage, he said, I was sent overseas, and I was sent to the Middle East, I was sent to Cairo. And, he said, and I was made a storeman in the base ordnance depot in Cairo. I said, oh yes. I said, well, that was a nice cushy number, wasn't it? So he said, yeah, that was very nice. I said, what did you do after that? He said, nothing. I was there the entire war, a storeman in the base ordnance depot in Cairo. Well, somebody had to be a storeman in the base ordnance depot. There's no justice in life, is there? I mean, I could have done a couple of years there and swapped with him. But, but I don't remember any feeling particular resentment. I just thought how damn lucky they were.
Now, one thing I'd forgotten was there was a period while you were, before you went out to Lavagli, where you were repairing the track up to Kokorutsa Spur. Do you remember that at all?
Well, now you mention it, and it doesn't even matter. Certainly we used to do that. We used to go out and provide protection for the sappers sometimes, you know, when they were repairing roads and tracks.
Now,
searching for mines.
Now, in January 1944, you actually had your Christmas celebrations at Lavagli, I think.
Yes.
A delayed party.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
No, but I do remember Christmas, by the way, just harking back. I forget exactly where we were, but we were still on that high ground in that broken country. And I remember hearing the Germans singing Silent Night. I'm trying to think what it is in German for a moment. Sort of somewhere down across the valley. And they probably could hear us too. But still, yes, we couldn't celebrate Christmas until, yes, Lavaglia was. That was on the Garigliano front, wasn't it? And we'd been in the San Carlo area before. I'm looking at a note that I see to my astonishment here that I made at the time, because I was very particular that we weren't allowed to keep a diary. But I've got a little tiny book here, which I've only come across in the past few days. I had no idea I'd kept this. But I see I've got here, Sunday the 2nd of January, 44, celebrated Christmas with Pongo Waring and Bill Miller. Bill Miller was another subaltern in the company with me. And Pongo Waring at that time was the company commander, I think. Yes, but that was just for a few days. And I see we went back into the line on the 5th of January, beside the York Lanks, beside the Americans. And that was in the foothills of the casino.
Do you remember that period at all? Because you were in this sort of general area for quite a while before you know, January, February, Garigliano River area.
Yes.
In the line for 6 weeks, I think, before you were relieved. Do you remember that time, any incidents that you recall, or just more of this routine?
I'm just looking at this little note I made here now. I do remember a particular incident, though the one I told you just now with the shell fire, control of the shell fire. That was during that period. That was somewhere there when we were across the Grigliano, or I can't remember actually crossing the Grigliano. I've actually prepared to cross it, but didn't succeed. I remember there was a place called Castelforte, which was sort of ahead of us on our left. I don't think we ever actually got to it. No, I have quite a lot of memories of that particular time. And yes, well, and I find among these few notes I've got here, they're just sort of desultory things here and there. But I noticed that, after the Christmas celebrations, we then went back into the line And that was just in front of Cassino. I'm not sure if I mentioned that earlier. Then I see that on the 10th of January, I note that I had been awarded the Military Cross for the Camino battle. That was that little incident I was telling you about with Ray Mitchell, and he must have written me up for that. And this time, the bacon came home, as it were.
Was that a source of great pride, the MC? Because it was a funny award. Sometimes they came up with the rations, and sometimes you had to do something quite brave for them.
I don't know. I don't think for platoon commanders they came up very, very frequently. They came up sometimes to company commanders, who'd commanded a successful attack, but hadn't done anything, perhaps personal. But sometimes, perhaps. But I think in general they were fairly well merited. Many equally merited, that's the thing that sticks in my mind, that I did many things which in my mind were equally meritorious, and some of them even more hazardous, which just weren't recognized at all. But that's just the luck of the draw. One doesn't complain, because to have some recognition was, I think I was quite chuffed about that, as they say, quite pleased about that. I remember Alan Hay told you, he always tells a story. And why was Alan Hay? Alan Hay must have been a commander of the company at that time, because I remember, perhaps I'm confusing two things, but I remember it was he, or the company commander at the time, who gave me this news. When the news had come, I'd been asleep, and they didn't wake me to tell me. It was not that important. Perhaps that gives some sort of answer to your question. I think he'd only just arrived, Alan Hay, that's what it was. And I remember at about the same time, I'd been out on a patrol, and I returned with a prisoner or two. And he was in his dugout, and he often tells his story with a great twinkle in his eye. And how I formed up, the first time I met him, and produced this German soldier. And of course, I asked him what I was to do with him, and he had the faintest idea. And he always associates that incident, with me. But anyway, so that's how I learned about that. And then I went on a patrol the very next day, patrolled the Rapido River, but I don't have any distinct recollection of that. But what I do remember, just a week or so later on, we went off on one of those short breaks. We were allowed to go to Naples, you referred to earlier. I went off to Sorrento, which is a lovely opportunity for about 3 or 4 days, and then straight back into the line again. And by that time, the battalion was the other side of the river Gragliano. I'd like just to read out a little bit. I see I noted here, this is the sort of thing that was just routine. This is Saturday, the 29th of January. Moved forward to Hill 400. Had few hours rest. Went forward with platoon all night. Infiltrated behind Jerry. Attacked at dawn. Captured 7. 2 Jerrys wounded. 1 of my men killed. Mawson. Pongo wounded. Bullet through lung.
Can you expand on that incident?
Well, I can, only because I have a recollection of doing this quite deep patrol. And somehow or another, there was a deep river gully. We got into this gully. And Private Mawson, who was a splendid man, he wouldn't say boo to a goose. And it's a very, very interesting lesson I learned from the war. The calm, quiet people like that, people, undistinguished people, you might think, not extroverted in any way, absolutely steady and reliable. And whereas other people who are showing great bravado, my God, I can't wait to get at them, like that, and they crumble in an instant. I've seen this happen time and time again. The moment they're fired on, they explode in a puff of smoke.
So you'd infiltrated by going up this gully that wasn't covered by the Germans?
The Germans were in it. That was the trouble. They were covering it, you see.
How had you got behind the German lines, then?
Just field craft.
They had separated positions.
Well, you couldn't have a man every... I mean, we used to talk about the thin red line in our war, but You know, there were gaps, and at night, through fieldcraft, you know, using your fieldcraft, you could work out a route and get through sometimes.
So you were going.
I don't say they didn't get through us sometimes, but.
So you were going up this gully, and what exactly happened?
Well, we were in the gully. Well, what I remember is, with sadness, great sadness, really, was a splendid man, and I think I recommended him for a military medal. I know I had it very much in mind to do so, but we were, and you know, I just can't recall it, but I can visualize this gully with German machine guns on, certainly on one side and probably on both sides. And we were trying to make progress, but I realized that we'd reached the point, you know, where we'd gone a bridge too far, if you like. You know, we were in a position that I was going to have difficulty in extricating ourselves from. And we were spread out to some extent, and he was in a leftmost position as we were going, as we came into this gully. And he was sort of towards the left, and lower down the gully than I was, as we came up to it on a sort of broadish ground, as I recall.
How many of you about?
Well, I had my platoon, I said, didn't I, yeah? So we must have been about, I don't know, we must have been quite a big party. You know, perhaps a dozen minimum, but maybe as many as 20. But poor old Morton, you know, I saw we'd gone too far, we came under fire. So we just had to get out of the gully, but he was hit and couldn't move. So it was a question then of whether anybody could go down and recover him or not.
Where was he hit?
Oh, I can't tell, because he was some sort of 30 or 40 yards from me, to my left, you see. And I agonized as to whether or not I should go or send anybody, you know, to try and get him out. Now, you know, I cannot remember now whether he was left there or whether we did get him out. But anyway, he died from those wounds, that's the point. He died from those wounds. And I know I have a slightly uneasy feeling as to whether or not, you know, we should hazard more of us to try and get him out. You couldn't rely on the Germans then. It wouldn't be any good taking a Red Cross flag or anything like that. If anybody else went down there, they would have been fired on as well. So he was just unlucky. But still, that was that. So Private Morton was killed, or died of his wounds. And then I see the next day I put down here, Jerry had counterattacked, but C Company drove him back again. Then on the 31st, came to Hill 320. These are all meters above sea level, by the way. We appreciate that. Those things are heights above sea level. Dug in. Had air mail from Mum and sea mail from Dad, by the way. That's something. Even then, you see, the post would come up to those positions with the rations when they came up.
Was the post very important to you?
Well, it was, obviously. Yes, it was. And vice versa. It appears that I received a comforts parcel about that time. Made good dugout and spent a comfortable night. This is all in this period.
What sort of thing would come in a comforts parcel?
Oh, probably, you know, a spare pair of socks and perhaps a little tin of sweets or something like that. It's extraordinary how one carried on. I mean, we were in the line, I think it said for 6 weeks, weren't we, over this period? You see.
That was the battalion, and your...
Yeah, it was the battalion, and I remember the 3 weeks, certainly, we were in. And I put here, wrote a few letters. I mean, this must have been in the dugout, for that moment. Wrote a few letters. Went up to 400 to relieve C Company. Wrote more letters. After dark, did a small recce patrol with two men. You see, this is only days after that. Big fighting patrol I was telling you about. And then on the 7th of February, relieved Forward Company. Jerry Patrol came in. We opened fire. They ran away, having first called on us to surrender. I remember that.
What do you remember of it?
I told them to get lost. Well, I mean, you know, there was no way. We were secure, you see, and they tried to intimidate us.
What would you first?
We've got to come out.
When did you know they were there? I mean, did they announce themselves, or did your sentry spot them?
We had our sentry spot, yes, that's right. Well, I mean, the alarm went up in some way. I can't remember now whether somebody called, shouted out and gave the alarm, and we obviously had drills. If anything was sighted, you know, and a shout was given, the word got round. And then I see it was on this occasion that I was speaking earlier, when I spotted the Jerry observation post, about 350 yards, I said to you, and that was roughly what I said before.
And that's the incident where you hit it with your holy...
down artillery on him. And then, I'll tell you one particular thing that isn't written down here, but I remember particularly about this period. The Germans, as I say, were about 300 or 400 yards away, and they had these Spandau machine guns, which you have heard of. And they were pretty fierce in things, so they had a very rapid rate of fire, and the bullets came over in absolute torrents. Now, they had my tactic was to lie low and not give away our position unless we were going to do an assault of some sort. But they would fire these weapons, you know, thinking to intimidate us.